Crispy Salsa here on this Wednesday, November 21st of 2012, and welcome to the 66th episode of the Last Best Deal podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at radioforall.net. I should also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alicize's A Puzzling Predicament, and the outro will be Bose's King's Quest, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons Attribution, specifically CC-BY-NC-SA 3.0 unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bastille blog, which is located over at The Last Bastille, Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E, thelastbastille.wordpress.com. For this particular episode, we're going to examine another topic within the huge, vast subject of dissident philosophy, that is the nitty-gritty of why good people oppose the establishment. We're going to be taking a look at, you know, the individual versus the collective, I guess you could say. And I'll be reading to you all an article that was originally published over at the blog, originally on October 6th of this year, entitled Individuality. Childhood is that pivotal period of one's life where character is forged. In school, children are taught to fit in with their arbitrary peer group, to respect authority, and most importantly, to never, ever deviate from the norm, whatever that happens to be at the moment. If one is not a team player, they are unjustly ridiculed for their individual autonomy. Indignities against self-determination are an indispensable hallmark of contemporary America. A while back, I was attending a local chapter meeting of the Libertarian Party, the LP, and one of the discussion topics that was brought up on the agenda was about government welfare. As the more vocal members began to eventually die down, I decided to chime in. Naively, I questioned why these libertarians were debating amongst themselves about what kinds of welfare they should apply for and how much, since welfare handouts are nothing more than those portions of stolen wealth that were looted from the populace in the first place. Not realizing it at the moment, I had unintentionally antagonized those LP members so badly that after my fairly brief critique, as well as answering some questions from the LP membership, the chapter chairman stood up and condescendingly quoted Ayn Rand at me in front of everyone. And for those of you who don't know, Ayn Rand was all in favor of applying for welfare, under the justification that it was somehow, mystically, getting some of your tax money back. I had essentially argued the opposite case, that by choosing to pursue the acquisition of it, you were sanctioning the original theft, especially since there is no accounting of whose wealth was stolen and in what proportions. A few years later, I was on a conference call with some fellow political dissidents, and we were chit-chatting about a variety of subjects, as well as on some ongoing efforts, when suddenly one of them mentioned about how I still maintained contact with some proprietarian anarchists, to which the other guy then made an insulting quip about how I should not waste my time with those particular dissidents at all. What really infuriated me about this was that these chuckling amigos of mine had just beforehand cowardly refused to participate in a badly needed project, so I was left doing my small portion of it all by myself instead of being able to mutually benefit from their collaborations as force multipliers. Groupthink is very much present in political dissident circles, much to my own dismay. Whether it be the devoted audiences, the Patriot rock stars, or the Ron Paul refugees, there is still very much a common desire to play follow the leader by propping up the immaculate virtues of a messiah like he's going out of style. While a voluntarily organized hierarchical brotherhood of nationalists is desirable for certain functions, that is not the same thing as the hero worship so common with many anti-establishment types, all the while nothing constructive or productive is being accomplished. As much as I've learned from the Austrian School of Economics, especially given they they make many of their books available for free download. I am a bit perturbed at the methodology of praxeology, a supposed field of science that blatantly rejects the scientific method. Social scientists can measure ordinal as well as continuous variables, that is, preference ordering alone versus preference ordering with equal unit differences, such as with votes or opinion polls. So I don't see how rejection of empirical observations, data sets, testing hypotheses, and interpreting results is at all truly scientific. Painting a broad brush against all the Austrians isn't fair either. Tom Woods is a far cry from Walter Block, since the former is a gentleman in public debates, whereas the latter likes to slander anyone who does not hop onto the Ron Paul bandwagon. Some people confuse egoism with individualism. While it is true that there is such an outlook called egoist individualism, courtesy of Max Steiner, those isms can be mutually exclusive. You can have individualists who care very deeply about the less privileged, and there are egoists who are very collectivistic. Personally, I think the term egoism is misleading. I think self-interest, or even selfishness, is preferably acceptable, so long as it is crystal clear that it is altruism, the notion that sacrifice, either of one's or especially of the self, is necessary so as to maintain order, is considered to be inimical to everyone's liberty. It is the pseudo-justification of the welfare state as well as the warfare state, the latter of which is justified by the concept that you must be willing to die for the self-aggrandizing glory of the nation-state. At most, society is really nothing more than the expressed preferences of individuals in the collective aggregate. As Professor de la Paz from The Moon is a Harsh Mistress said, quote, "A rational anarchist believes that concepts such as state and society and government have no existence save as physically exemplified in the acts of self-responsible individuals. He believes that it is impossible to shift blame, share blame, distribute blame, as blame, guilt, responsibility are matters taking inside human beings singly and nowhere else. But being rational, he knows that not all individuals hold his evaluations, so he tries to live perfectly in an imperfect world, aware that his effort will be less than perfect, yet undismayed by self-knowledge of self-failure." Emphasis added. Close quote. While such collective nouns and adjectives are convenient for linguistic use, conceptually speaking, if they lack tangible existence, then they are simply fictional. A tree is a real individual thing, whereas a forest is a collection of trees, even though it's simply an abstract grouping of trees. This gives missing the forest for the trees an additional meaning where the devil is in the details, not to mix metaphors. You might be pleasantly surprised if you treat people as individuals instead of as members of forests. Your best ally could be a disgruntled government agent who wants to seek revenge against his current or former employer. Likewise, your worst foe could be that sniveling acquaintance of yours who's more than happy to rat you out in the mistaken belief that he's somehow saving his own hide. Whenever individuals become part of groups, they mistakenly believe that responsibility is somehow diffused. What they fail to realize is that each and every one of them who did something is fully responsible for what he alone did. And why is it that we feel so powerless alone, even when history has repeatedly shown us that it is the individual, the lone ranger, so to speak, who acts outside the realm of the norm in order to effect positive change? So what if the nature of our existence is that we are essentially all alone? We all dream alone, we all feel pain alone, and we all die alone. That does not mean we are powerless. Far from it. If you simply change your belief about your alleged powerlessness, then your natural power that you have over your own life begins to return to you, and to you alone. And so what? That is powerful enough, by far. And again, that is my article on individuality, and now for a hopefully brief postscript. You know, in terms of trying to examine the social phenomenon, things like trends, fashion, you know, fashion styles, even, you know, socio-political movements, etc. The only way to really describe it, because because the observations themselves are inherently just expressions of the collective aggregate, is to necessarily describe it in collective terms. I mean, for example, such things like the environmental movement, the patriot movement, the liberty movement, the the truth movement, the birther movement, the most recent tenther movement, all of these. These are all just forests, really. And they're the most forestry of the forest, if you will, because it's not like it's a static forest. It's very fluid. That's inherently dynamic, respectively, too. I mean, it's, some people, a lot of times people drifting in and out of it. It's not like you've got like a membership card to the Liberty Movement or something. And, in a lot of ways, I mean, that's why if in terms of linguistic descriptors for phenomenon that can really only be expressed in a collective aggregate, that's why I prefer like communities. And communities used to be where it was geographically defined, and in some ways still can be, such as like what you and your neighbors can do. But I would also say that there are the communities of interest, people who associate with each other around a central theme or topic or something like that, and who also would otherwise not really associate with each other really for any other reason, and generally speaking, don't really know too much about each other's lives for the most part, outside of their common shared interest, which of course is not a bad thing at all. I mean, it just is what it is. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a community of interest now, would it? Which is why I've a lot of times used the expression the patriot community, for example. Hell, you could also say liberty community, too. But in terms of a community of interest, I think that's about as close as you're going to get in terms of more fluid social phenomenon. For more precise, more static kinds of forests, you can point to certain groups. You can point to Food Not Bombs. You can point to Oath Keepers. You can point to your local, your run-of-the-mill local militia unit. Because, like, for example, a militia is just a forest of citizen soldiers, really. I mean, I guess guerrillas to some extent as well. Not all, of course, but let's just say citizen soldiers, because that kind of covers the gambit. And it is the citizen soldiers who are the real tangible thing that exists. It's when their behavior is coordinated in a group way, when they, even if it's just a four-man fire team, doing battle drills or something, or even, hell, even doing an actual operation, then it's a militia unit of some kind. Or at least maybe like a sub aspect of it. You see, the point is that the collective descriptors are not actually real. It's those individuals that are doing things. For instance, also, certain people would say that, it was the United States' fault that something happened, or, it was Russia's fault that something happened. Well, what are these nation states? Technically, nation states are just mega forests at most. And again, kind of like the quote from Professor De La Paz, that fictional character. The state or government is just a collective aggregate of individuals who are under a common delusion that they supposedly have some sort of higher claim upon your life than you do. That's it. I'm not going to get into issues of mental illness, but it is a delusion. Because if it was voluntarily contracted into, it really wouldn't be the state now, would it? And I don't want to get too deeply into the whole aspect of social contract and consent of the governed, but suffice it to say, governments rule by force. I mean, at the end of the day, it's all about coercion. And the whole point of any form of the night watchman state was to minimize the abuse that governments, but really those deluded individuals who like to, in the collective aggregate, call themselves government, those individuals have a tendency to become tyrannical because other people have kind of, in a manner of speaking, also participated in the delusion by saying, oh yeah, well, I accept your authority to rule over me. And of course, as was covered on the previous podcast, you know, the office or an authority is just, it's imaginary, it's fictional. You know, it's like these statutes on the books. It's just, you know, the only thing that's actually real is the agreement. I mean, that's it. I mean, it's the contract, if you will. And if the contract's not there, then it resorts back to force, physical force or coercion or something more along those lines. But that's it. I mean, there is no there's not really anything else going on here because pretty much just about everything else is more or less fictional, especially the more abstract it becomes. The more fictional it tends to be. You know, and also let's look at something else. I mean, even the most hardcore propertarian / individualistic anarchists I've come across will say society, will use the term society a lot. And by extension, the constitutionalists and other minarchists, etc. But that term, society, so even if you've got somebody who is inherently anti-statist in some way, shape, or form, they're against big government, let's put it that way. I find it fascinating that they always talk about society, which is part of the reason I like to use the term civilization. It's admittedly a different collective descriptor that's just linguistically convenient and efficient. And it's just an aggregation of just lots of people acting in a very similar fashion in terms of trends and stuff like that, or who have shared language and that sort of thing. But, you know, society, contrary to popular belief, is not just this megalithic Godzilla-type creature that stomps around and does shit. I mean, it's not as if society is like, doom, 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 society smash. No. Society doesn't do shit, okay? It's just a forest. That's it. It's just a forest. Who you really want to care about are the X number of individuals that comprise any given forest, society, if you will. That's it. A forest does not go, doo doo, I am forest smash. Same thing with any of this other stuff. And I know this may run against the feelings of most political dissidents, but hear me out here for a second. I would even postulate and agree with that fictional character, the professor, by even saying government doesn't even go around and do stuff. Because a lot of times you hear about, a lot of the news and analysis you hear in the alternative media, a lot of it will say things like, well, the government today decided to censor more things in the public sphere or something along those lines. Or, you know, the government decided to do the 20 millionth awful thing this week, and we'll tell you all the 50 million different details of how it all goes down, which will, of course, rob you of your time and prevent you from doing something actually beneficial, et cetera, et cetera. But again, to be fair, government or the state is just a collective aggregate. You know, there is no government monster, even though a lot of constitutionalists specifically don't like big government. Technically, the government does not walk around, doo, 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 government smash. Even though a lot of us feel that it kind of does that, it technically doesn't. All you have in reality, things that are like testable in the natural world, the only thing you have going on are just similar individuals who are delusional, or perhaps just mistaken if you want to get rid of the mental illness connotations, but you have delusional individuals who sincerely have faith, because it's all based on faith, is have faith in the notion or in the concept that somehow they possess a higher claim on your life than you do. They inherently do not accept the self-ownership axiom or any derivative or version on a theme of that at all. It's directly contradictory to it. Because if they did, they wouldn't be part of this, you know, collective aggregate called the government or the state. It would just be, you know, you, me, and the guy down the street, you know, trading and all that. Oh, and as a final note, too, you know, also a lot of dissonance will talk about the free market. Even the market anarchists, the anarcho-capitalists, the voluntarists, you know, whatever label they're putting themselves under, you know, this week, because they keep changing the name. It's kind of annoying. But it's the same batch of folks, the people who are like your run-of-the-mill minarchists, the only difference being that they don't sincerely think that any form of the state, even a version of the Night Watchman state, one manifestation of which would be a constitutional republic, can ever secure their property. And by extension, their liberties and lives. But yeah, even those guys keep talking about the free market, like the free market does something. Well, the free market does this, and the free market does that, and the government, when the government does something, the government interferes with the free market and all that. And it's like, hold on a second. All the free market is a forest. It is a collective aggregation of people just voluntarily trading you know, property, services, and I would also say ideas. That's it. So, you know, one collective aggregate thing, mythology, I guess, was all based on coercion, and the other one's all based on, you know, on trade, basically. And then, of course, corporatism is the ideology where you kind of pervert the collective aggregate of the free market into this other horrible thing, which basically benefits off government privilege. So people still trade, but then if the trades don't go exactly their way and exactly the way they want because they're control freaks, they then get the coercion guys to step in. But even when we're talking about things in terms of power dynamics and institutions and that sort of thing, all we're talking about are just individuals who have offices which are themselves fictional, but individuals who are simply having certain roles that with certain behaviors and certain activities that they perform in order to achieve stated goals of whatever it is, even if it is to be a tyrant, you know, tyrannical, against other people. I mean, that's it. I mean, so yeah, we can use this flowery language, like, for example, the iron fist of the state versus the invisible hand of the free market, but the iron fist and the invisible hand are just metaphors or symbols for different collective aggregates of different kinds of behavior. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, that's all it is. You know, there's nothing magical about the free market. Don't take that out of context, by the way. There's nothing magical about the free market. There's also similarly nothing magical about government. All you have is just individuals having faith in one kind of behavior versus individuals having faith in a different kind of behavior. And yes, they are, generally speaking, pretty much contradictory. I mean, they just are. You know, I don't know how else to say it. And then, of course, you know, when there's, like, street-level crimes and all that, the free market is smart and innovative enough to, you know, learn how to defend itself from violent aggression. And, of course, the government, the collective aggregate of delusional individuals, are the best skilled and best and the most wealthy of the different street-level gangs, as well as having a propaganda apparatus that provides it with a false sense of legitimacy, i.e. a faith in it, that lends some aspects of the free market and just the public in general, which again, that's the other thing too, just to believe in the supposed legitimacy of the state. And as a side note too, even when you say, like a lot of times you'll hear me talk about the mainline public, or hell, how about just political dissonance? That's a collective aggregate. You see, so much of the language, whenever you use something that's like a plural, either plural possessive, plural nouns, whatever, you're talking about, you know, a lot of times you're talking about collective aggregates. I mean, it's one thing if you're saying like three geese or something, but then you're denoting, you know, three individual geese, you know, doing whatever. But there are certain words that inherently are forests. They have to be. So that's pretty much kind of the problem, too, is that a lot of that came about, as I said earlier, for efficiency and ease of communication. But then unfortunately, as time goes on and these things are, and this very basic assumption is not explained, then people start thinking that these collective things walk around and do stuff. I mean, the government does not walk around and do stuff. Society does not walk around and do stuff. The free market does not go around and do stuff. They're just individuals having faith in a certain idea, role, behavior, concept, whatever descriptors you want to add on to it, that are just acting in a certain way. I mean, that's it. You know, for example, if you have certain specific individual representatives or so-called representatives in the Congressional House up on, you know, Capitol Hill, then, you know, those guys are responsible for the individual votes they take on certain bills. So, I mean, that's the other thing. Like, Congress itself is a collective aggregate of, like, 400-some-odd individuals. I mean, that's the problem. It's epidemic, but it kind of has to be in some way, because it would take too long to say, well, the 400-and-some-odd individuals who... No, you just say Congress. So it's an efficiency issue. But here's the point. The problem with doing that so much is that it really gets it really gets kind of bastardized to the point where kind of the idea of like walking of the collective thing walking around stomping and doing stuff is really the issue about the transference of responsibility. And so, oh, like the Congress is responsible. And yeah, a lot of our grievances do have to do with collective aggregates of the government, which itself is a collective aggregate, going around doing stuff. But what we're really upset about at the end of the day is not these fictional things. What we're upset about are these individuals who have faith in this thing who are going around being bad. That is what we have a problem with. You have a problem with individuals doing things that hurt our liberties, that hurt our way of life. And that, yeah, definitely some version of criminal trespass at the very least, absolutely. And, you know, some people might misunderstand me and say, well, why don't you just talk about the president or something? Because it's not about him, whoever he happens to be at this particular moment. And obviously, last episode was about, you know, the office, and I'm not talking about the office, I'm talking about the individual guy, whoever that is. But it's not just him. It's the 435 bonehead, or 400-some-odd boneheads, who like to dance around and, you know, come up with orders for another batch of individuals to follow, who then have different, you know, a chain of command of different levels of individuals, all following the orders of the higher level individuals above them, and then it kind of trickles down in a manner of speaking. And then it affects us being the 300 some odd million people living in this geographic area, this tax plantation that is called the USS of A, with its borders and whatnot. And even that's fictional. When you say, like, United States of America, when you say Russia, when you say Kazakhstan, these things do not exist in reality. They're just abstractions. They're concepts. It are a commonly believed concept. What is real and what is tangible are things like the land, the air, the animals, our species, etc. So the land of the USS of A is real. You know, the Southwest with its climate, the Midwest and the Prairie Lands with their climate, the Eastern Seaboard and its climate. Different areas of the Middle East and their various climates. I mean, like, those things are real. But anything that denotes, you know, pretty much at this point, arbitrarily defined lines are not really real. I mean, that just come about partially through contract and partially through force, i.e., if you cross this mountain range, I'm going to kill you. And then that kind of, I mean, and, you know, that's one version. Other times it's like, look, we're just setting up our home here, and, you know, between this orchard, you know, between this corner of this tree to that hedgerow over there, and they delineate the borders, then this is our home, and don't, you know, cross our home because that's trespass, and, you know, we're willing to defend it and the rest of it. But if you want to come across to trade, and we're happy to do that. It's basically defining limits, and there's nothing really wrong with defining limits. the issue here is just to, with this soliloquy of sorts on individuality, I guess you could say, is really the important thing is really not so much distinction between the individual and the collective, which is fundamental, which is important, but I guess much more fundamentally, even more so than that, is distinguishing between what's real and what's fictional. You know, Russia does not exist. The Russian people, those individuals do exist. They just happen to have a fictional moniker of them, of people who happen to live in a specific geographical area defined by borders. And same thing with all these statutes on the books. I mean, really, if anyone's being honest, technically they're threats of violence. If you do these things, we will consider that we, the government, or whatever, again, self-delusional individuals or whatever, we will just assume that this is an injury upon us, and we will see, and if you are caught, we will punish you. And the punishment, the actual violence, that's real. So it's this weird interplay. So yeah, whenever you hear terms like tyrannical government, like what does that mean? I want to get too etymological here, but it's kind of a serious consideration. What exactly does that mean? Oh, you mean a bunch of individuals who are delusional in the first place, who assume who have this assumption of having a higher claim on other people's lives than those people do, basically being bullies. Yeah, that's tyrannical government in a nutshell. And, oh, by the way, I forgot to add that they have the ability and the will, they not only have the willingness, but also the pragmatic ability to do that. They've got those very real things called Harrier jets and nukes and militarized police and firearms and tasers and the rest of it, with which to harm people, yet it's bad for the people who are not part of this collective aggregate called the state to have something just even one fraction of that stuff, those tools, which would be usually most likely firearms. I wonder why that would be. Maybe because the one group of delusional individuals are hell-bent on maintaining power forcibly over the people that are not as well-armed? I wonder how that happened. But yes, but do keep in mind that, especially in political discourse, that a lot of the terms being used are used in terms of convenience, especially in terms of describing collective aggregates. But do keep in mind, they're not real. The things that are real are human beings, individuals. Are the land, the animals, the physical environment, nature, if you will. Violence is real. If I punch you in the face, that's very much real. There's no abstraction, there's nothing. I mean, that's real. If I contract, or if instead I contract with you, that agreement is real. I trade one pair of shoes for your five loaves of barley or something. That's real. But not this other stuff where it's all this highfalutin concepts and all this stuff. And I know that may sound funny coming from me because I do spend some level of time talking about that. But at the end of the day, what it really comes down to is just really understanding what's actually real and keeping that perspective. Now, if you understand that and you accept it as being validly true, then yeah, feel free to use collective the terms for collective aggregates. Just don't ever fall into the trap of either A, believing they're real, or B, and this is more importantly, transferring responsibility over to them. Oh, the military went around and did this stuff. No. Those soldiers, and different kinds of soldiers, tankers, helicopter pilots, etc., those individual soldiers went and invaded that particular town. Even a town's a collective aggregate, but you know what I'm getting at. So, responsibility is inherent in individuals for what they alone themselves do. So I hope that comes through pretty clearly, because it's kind of lost on people. For next episode, we will explore dissonant philosophy by examining pacifism. I'm Sleepy Salsa, thanks for listening.